Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Dr. Kiki's Science Hour is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Dr. Kiki Science Hour with me, Dr. Kiki Sanford, episode 106, recorded on Thursday, July 28th, 2011. Infecting the Brick House. This episode of Dr. Kiki's Science Hour is brought to you by Squarespace.com, the fast and easy way to create a high-quality website or blog. For a free trial and 10% off your new account for 6 months, go to Squarespace.com and use offer code Kiki7. Welcome, everyone, to Dr. Kiki's Science Hour. I'm Dr. Kiki. This is episode 106, and I hope you're ready. Because we're in a brand new studio. I'm so excited about this. We're in the Brick House. I had to be here in person, and this might be the beginning of a new trend, being here in person as opposed to over the internets. But anyway, I hope you are ready to dig into the science, because that's what the Science Hour is all about, an hour of focusing on one topic with an expert in an area of the sciences. And today, we're focusing on viruses. And my guest is Dr. Vincent Racaniello. He is, according to his Google profile, Professor Virus Guru, science podcaster, and blogger. So he is a very well-rounded scientific renaissance man, and I'm really looking forward to talking with him today about viruses. But first, a few science headlines. Let's dig into them. 1 year after being published in the journal Science, a study claiming to pinpoint the genetic variants related to longevity has been retracted due to faulty results. However, the researchers say the results are still valid, even though independent analysis says that they aren't, and they're planning to republish the study somewhere else. Right. Anyway, moving on, publishing in the Royal Society of Biology Letters, scientists find that people living at higher latitudes have larger brains and eyes. So living closer to the poles doesn't increase intelligence at all. Just because the brain's larger doesn't mean they're smarter. The larger brain capacity is thought to be related solely to helping people deal with diminished light. Using optogenetic methods, that's light being light pulses and nerves, researchers were able to turn behaviors in bioengineered mice on and off at the flip of a switch. Pulses of light enabled controlled neurons in the brains of the mice, making them more or less aggressive and more or less social, providing a model with which to study behavioral disorders as they arise in humans. The NIH gets to give money to stem cell researchers, embryonic stem cell researchers, that is. A trial judge has issued summary judgment on behalf of the National Institutes of Health's decision to fund stem cell research in a case brought against it by adult stem cell researchers claiming injury related to being put at a funding disadvantage, having to compete for funding against embryonic stem cell research. So, point for embryonic stem cell research. JPL researchers have confirmed the Pioneer anomaly. That's right, anomalous deceleration is occurring. The data containing an exponential drop suggestive of radioactive decay support the idea that onboard heat is the source. Astronomers at Caltech have verified the existence of another potentially habitable exoplanet. With an elliptical orbit that is similar in length to Earth's, it could support liquid water. This is very exciting. However, it's not the size of Earth, it's the size of Neptune, and it's in a binary solar system, meaning it has two suns. And in the case of Earth, we could really be alone here in our rock, on our rock in space. Astrobiologists took a new perspective on the Drake equation, and they suggest that the probability of life arising on a planet in a habitable zone around a star could be arbitrarily rare, meaning that life may only have arisen once in the entire universe. Finally, are cancers a parasite? controversy-igniting cancer researcher Peter Duisberg thinks so. In a recent paper, he suggests that karyotype variants lead to cancer rather than mutations. He might be lighting a fire in the scientific literature with this one, and maybe we'll talk about that a bit on today's show. It's time to bring in our guest, Dr. Vincent Racaniello. He's a professor of microbiology and immunology at Columbia University in New York. He runs a research lab where they study poliovirus, rhinoviruses, and other RNA viruses. He loves teaching about viruses. He has many websites, virology.ws and TWIV, This Week in Virology.tv. He also has some classes in iTunes University. And you want to be the world's virology professor. How's that going for you?
I'm working on it. We're in many, many countries. Problem is, I only speak English, and a lot of people don't. But I'm making a lot of progress. I think we have a lot of people who know a lot more about viruses than they did before I started.
Yep. Well, thank you so much for joining me today. I'm really excited to have you on the show and to, you know, have the world's virology professor to teach us virology today.
We could do that in an hour.
Okay, great. All of virology, 1 hour. To get started, I was curious to find out what got you interested in virology. Why this direction of study? And specifically within that poliovirus, the rhinovirus, the RNA virus family?
It's an easy question because when I was in college, I read a book called Fever. And it was about the outbreak of Lassa fever virus in Africa. It was the first emerging virus infection. And I loved it. I said I had to do this. So I went to college and prepared myself for a career. I worked in labs. And then I went to PhD program and I worked on an RNA virus, influenza. But that was just for my PhD. When it then came to do a postdoc, which as you know sets you up for the rest of your career, I said to my advisor, where should I go? And he said, pick the best lab you can find. And at the time, this was 1975, '79. The best lab was that run by David Baltimore, the Nobel laureate. And so I went there, and he worked, among other things, on polio. So that's how I ended up on polio.
Excellent. And has polio research, have you come a long way in understanding the virus over the many years that it's been studied?
I would say it's probably among the best studied viruses. In fact, until HIV came along, it may have been the best studied virus. We and others have made such amazing progress. It's a great virus to work with. It grows beautifully. It's easy to measure it. There are lots of ways to study it. We have incredible reagents. So we just know this virus inside out. But in the last 10 years or so, research on the virus has been waning because it's about to be eradicated. And along with eradicating the virus, we're going to eradicate the people who study it, including me.
Right. You get rid of a virus, you don't have anything to study anymore, and then what do?
Well, fortunately, there are plenty of viruses out there. And for me, it was easy to pick a related virus. So it makes sense to study something related to what you're used to studying. So we picked rhinoviruses, which are highly related to polio. They're medically really important. There are a lot of interesting questions to be asked. And so it was an easy decision. But even if you didn't want to pick a related virus, I mean, there are just billions and billions of them out there, and you could just pick one and you'd be all set.
One virus to rule them all. In terms of studying viruses, let's define a virus and let's define a few terms so that people don't get lost in the discussion as we go along. Where do we start? What's a virus?
So we call viruses obligate intracellular parasites.
Parasites.
So parasites.
Really?
Yes, they are parasites. They have to get into a cell in order to multiply. So that's the intracellular part. And obligate means there's no choice. The virus has to get in the cell, otherwise it just sits wherever it is and does nothing. Okay? And we used to say they are very small, but recently many viruses have been identified that are actually quite large. So we've taken that out of the definition.
Okay. How many, if we're looking at the genetic code for a virus compared to, what's the size of a virus code?
Right. There's a tremendous range. So some viruses have 1,000 and a few, say 1,200 nucleotides, and maybe encode for one or two proteins. That would be like one or two genes. So those are among the smallest viruses. The biggest have over 1 million base pairs of DNA and encode over 1,000 proteins. So they have over 1,000 genes. So you have a very big range. And of course, that's what we know of, what's what we've discovered. And these biggest viruses have only been discovered in the past 5 years or so. So maybe there are more big ones out there.
Are those the very, very large ones? Are those the viruses that were suggested to be a fourth domain of life, that they're getting large enough to actually maybe be considered their own branch of the tree of life?
Yes. So some of these big viruses are called MIMI viruses, and they infect amoeba. And they are considered by many to perhaps be another branch because they have different combinations of genes from viruses. They have genes from sources that we don't even know about. There's a lot of debate about this. It's not clear, but a few people have suggested that this might be the case.
What do you think?
Well, I think calling it a form of life is problematic because I personally don't view a virus as being living.
Right.
But I mean, you could say that's a technicality. But let's include everything under the definition of life. I don't think we have enough evidence yet to say that this is a fourth branch. I think it's pretty tenuous. So I would say no, not at this point.
What kind of evidence do you think is necessary to call it its own branch of life?
Well, some of these big viruses do have genes which are related to other existing viruses. So in my view, that would make them related to all the viruses that we know of. And we're certainly not going to put those in a separate branch. In fact, many people want them included on the tree of life. You know, the so-called tree of life exclude viruses at this moment.
Right.
And people want to include them to it. So I think they would have to be much more unrelated than they are to be classified entirely separately. You know, they have a lifestyle that looks like a virus, so I would place them in that category as it is. If we found something very, very different, then, okay, it could be a fourth branch, but so far I don't see that.
Okay. I just find it really interesting, the whole idea of viruses and the fact that they aren't considered alive, that they are, as you said, obligate parasites, that they require living cells to exist. They infect cells in order to replicate themselves to various ends. And so there is some kind of a function in what they do. They are little machines, but you know, it's such a blurry line with viruses as to where they are. And then there's also the idea that viruses, specifically maybe RNA viruses, could be giving us a clue as to how life evolved, that maybe life came from RNA in the first place and moved to become DNA over time.
Right. So, I mean, I think let's start at the beginning. You have a virus particle, and that is what goes from cell to cell. You inhale virus particles, for example, they cause a cold, they replicate in you, they then spread to others. So that's a virus particle. That is what I would say is not living.
Right.
Because virus particles can sit on your desk forever and not do anything. But once the virus particle gets inside of a cell, then it begins to reproduce, it takes over the cell. So you could view the virus-infected cell as being living.
Mm-hmm.
That would be fine. So this is an interesting mixture of its life cycle. You have periods when it's not living, periods when it is living. I mean, spores are like that, bacterial spores. Seeds are really like that. A seed isn't living until you give it nutrients, and then it grows into a plant or a tree. So viruses can be somewhat like that.
Hmm.
Right? They have two distinct parts of their life cycle.
Yeah.
Now, the RNA world, Remember, now, this is a theory that the earliest forms of life were RNA-based, and that's called the RNA world. And maybe the viruses that exist today that have RNA as their genomes, maybe they're relics of this RNA world. And then maybe evolution figured out how to make from RNA DNA, and then DNA predominated, and that's the world we have today. So maybe RNA viruses are relics of that world. It's a very interesting theory.
Maybe your research you're working on relics, on ancestors of life, in a way.
This is amazing that you can work on something that may have been around for, who knows, billions of years.
Yeah. So there's a question from the chat room. How does a virus get into a cell without doing anything that will define it as alive? I find that's a really interesting question.
Yeah, well, cells have many processes for taking up material from outside. Cells have to take in nutrients of various sorts, mm-hmm. Small molecules and big ones. So they have pathways that are just dedicated to that. So a cell has to take up a protein. The protein binds to a receptor, which is a protein on the cell surface, and then the cell takes it up by a very specific process. Viruses simply hijack those processes. Viruses are moving around in your bodily fluids. They encounter a cell, they bump into it. If it has the right receptor for it on the cell surface, it'll get pulled into that cell. So the cell is unwittingly pulling a virus in, thinking it's a cargo like something else it wants. But then once the virus gets into the cell, it begins to reprogram what's going on in there. So it's passive. The virus isn't doing anything to get in the cell. It's bumping into various cells, and as soon as it hits the right one, it will get in.
So it's kind of luck of the draw. It's not it's not directed except by chance and maybe having little matching puzzle pieces.
It is absolutely luck of the draw, and that's one reason why when viruses reproduce, they make so many of themselves.
Yeah.
Because they have to increase the probability that they will find the right cell.
In terms of it being passive, so how does the immune system play into fighting against viruses, and what's the interplay? Is this, you know, in biology, there's ecology, there's the predator-prey interaction. Is there a similar kind of fight going on in the immune system with viruses?
Yeah, absolutely, on a daily basis, because I like to say that we live and prosper in a literal cloud of viruses. Every day we inhale, we ingest, we get on our skins millions and millions, perhaps billions of virus particles. For example, the ocean contains 1 million virus particles per milliliter. All right, 1 million per milliliter.
Per milliliter.
Milliliter.
They have to be so tiny to fit that many in such a small amount. A milliliter is not much.
Milliliter is small, and you can't see viruses, so they are very, very tiny. You can put millions on the head of a pin. Mm-hmm. So the oceans are full of them. The next time you go out and look at the ocean, you know, this vast sea of water, just remember, it is full of viruses. And in fact, here's a great number. If you took all the viruses in the oceans of the world, and the number is something like 10 to the 30th power. And if you line them up from head to tail, or just line them up in some way, they would stretch 200 million light years into space. This is huge. That's way out there, right? It's way past the nearest galaxy.
Right.
So they're all over the place, and they're always infecting us. And the only reason we're healthy and we survive is we have this great immune system, which actually is multi-component. And every day, our immune system is getting rid of these viruses that come into us. There are non-specific ways, and there are very specific ways that the immune system deals with them. And it's only when the viruses get past a certain number of the immune system walls, I'd like to call them, then you start to get sick.
Right. It's just amazing to think how bombarded we are constantly by not just viruses. Viruses are one, bacteria,
sure.
are others. So the germs in the world, just how surrounded we are and how well we do. It's just mind-boggling to me. I'm thinking also about vaccinations and how that might help boost our immunity and help, and how does that help in our fight against viruses?
So even though our immune system is pretty good at keeping us healthy, eventually viruses get past a lot of our defenses and they make us sick. And that's simply, again, it's a numbers game. You get so many assaults on a daily basis that eventually one of them is going to be successful in the virus's world, and that it replicates in you and you get sick. So vaccines are an effort to avoid that. We immunize ourselves to prevent the virus from getting to the point where it makes us sick. So it mimics the exact processes that go on when we get a natural infection, except we don't get sick. So when you get a vaccine, you either don't get sick at all, you get very minor symptoms, and then you're protected against being infected. So there are wonderful inventions that have been devised since Louis Pasteur's time and probably before, and they really do help us stay healthy.
In terms of vaccines, I have a 4.5-month-old son, and he's been vaccinated for rhinoviruses, which is what you study as well. In terms of what you study, is the virus itself more important, or is the immune system more important in defining the study of your organism?
So first, let me correct you. There is no rhinovirus vaccine, so your child must have received some other vaccine.
Oh.
We would love to have
I'm thinking of something else then. Yeah.
Well, he certainly got a polio vaccine, because we do immunize children in this country against polio. But rhinoviruses are actually very difficult to immunize against because there are so many of them. There are over 100 different kinds of rhinoviruses.
Okay.
And we haven't figured out how to make a vaccine that would protect against 100 different viruses. But your question is, when you study viruses, do you study the virus or the immune response, which is more important?
Yeah.
Well, it really depends on your interests. Unfortunately, there are scientists who study viruses. There are scientists who study the immune response. And there are very few who do both. We always try to hire them when we find them, but most people have a very polarized view. They're interested in just the virus or just the immune response. Well, in fact, the two cannot be separated. The
right.
two go hand in hand. My view is, if you study the immune response, there's no point in studying it without studying a pathogen, which is what the immune response is for, to defend us against pathogens.
Mm-hmm.
So my whole career, I spent studying just the virus. So I did something that I'm highly critical of, and I ignored the immune response. And about 8 years ago, I got very interested in immune responses, and we began to incorporate that into our work. And it's very rewarding because you look at the whole picture. And we also developed an animal model that we could use to study infection. So you put the whole thing together. You have the virus infecting an animal, and you look at the immune response against it.
Understanding exactly how it all works together, I think, the whole picture must be much better to study. I just realized someone wrote in the chat room, it's rotavirus that I was thinking of.
Absolutely,
yeah.
Yes.
In terms of the rhinovirus, you said there are over 100 different variants, different types of rhinovirus.
Right.
I know recently, within the last year, they've been talking about a universal vaccine for the flu. That has been based on I don't understand exactly how that works either, but is there a possibility of coming up with a universal vaccine for the rhinoviruses as well? Or
right.
And if not, why are they more complicated?
Right. So the universal flu vaccine, which is being developed and may be available in 10 years, is based on finding very conserved parts of certain viral proteins that are found in all the different flu viruses that exist now and which ever will exist. So flu is difficult because it changes every year, and every year or two or three, we need to change the vaccine. And this is difficult because you have to go back and be re-immunized, you have to manufacture more vaccines. It would be nice to have a universal vaccine.
Mm-hmm.
And just in the past few years, people have identified conserved residues, which probably will form the basis of these excuse me, vaccines. Now, in theory, you could do the same thing for a rhinovirus, and I don't see why you couldn't. But flu is a much more serious disease than rhinovirus. The common cold, which is what rhinovirus essentially does, is a lot less serious than flu. So flu gets a lot more attention. But I think that eventually we'll get to the point where we make a universal rhino vaccine as well.
I think that would be great. And the common cold, I guess, as you said, it's not as deadly, not as dangerous as the flu. So it's not necessarily something that people are going to focus on right away or focus the energy and the money into.
But it certainly is annoying. I mean,
yeah.
I have, especially when you have children, as you will find out, you will get a cold at a very regular rate, and you will pinpoint the day that the cold begins. You'll feel a scratchiness in your sore throat, mm-hmm. and it'll be difficult for you to sleep at night because if you sleep on your back and mucus drains down your throat, it will irritate your throat. These are just wonderful things that children bring home from school. So it would be great to have a vaccine that you get early in life
yeah.
that just prevents all of this from happening. And to take it one step further, there is a lot of good evidence now that rhinoviruses can also cause more serious lower respiratory tract infections. So we would like to be able to prevent those as well. So it's a good idea to make a rhinovirus vaccine that would hit all of these variants at once.
What is it that sets rhinoviruses apart for your interest? What is it? What area of what is it about rhinoviruses that you're specifically interested in studying?
Okay, so with polio, it was quite obvious that polio causes a paralytic disease, which is really serious. We have to understand how this works. And then when it came time for me to switch to a different virus, because as we said, polio was about to be eradicated.
Yeah.
Rhino was an obvious choice because, first of all, it causes about half of all common colds. So common colds are these upper respiratory tract infections where you have runny nose, sore throat, sometimes cough, just annoyances. Over half of all those are caused by rhinoviruses. But they are also significant causes of asthma attacks. So it turns out that most asthma attacks occur when you have a respiratory infection. And since rhino causes most of them, it's a big cause of asthma. But no one knows why infection triggers an asthma attack.
So
and we thought that would be something to work on.
Right. So there's not any direct link between the infection causing inflammation leading to the asthma attack.
Presumably that's what's going on.
Yeah.
We think there must be some immune response to the virus that is overdone in some way, such it makes your, you know, it makes your respiratory tract constrict and cause all the symptoms of an asthma attack. It's very difficult to study. Many people have tried looking in people that have rhinovirus colds and have asthma and asking, is there something special about them? But it's very hard to tease out. It would be nice to have a small animal model in which to do that. And that's one of the things we have tried to do for many years. We were very successful at doing this for polio. It was the simple matter of taking that protein on the cell surface, which we talked about before, the protein that lets viruses get in, and take that human protein and put it in a mouse. And that was enough to give mice polio.
Using the virus to get the human cell in, presumably.
So we use a protein that's usually letting the virus into human cells. We put
yeah.
it in mice, and the mice can get infected. So we wanted to do the same thing with rhinovirus. If we could get mice sneezing with runny noses and getting asthma attacks after being infected, then we could tease out what's the molecular mechanism. But we haven't been able to do that.
So it's just proving more difficult than you had thought. Which is
yes,
usually the
absolutely.
Case in science, right?
Yes.
You
yes,
approach
it is.
A problem,
we have some
you go,
ideas.
This looks easy. This looks interesting.
Yes. Yes. And that's fine because it's good to be challenged as a scientist. And as technology advances, you can find new ways to solve your problems. Absolutely.
Yeah. And I think it's very interesting. I've never had asthma myself until mm-hmm. this year. I recently got exercise asthma, and it was related to a sinus infection that I got earlier this year, and then that infection led to having periodic asthma. So it's an interesting question to me now that I'm tied to an inhaler when I want to go exercise.
Yeah, well, when we get sick, we often get very interested in understanding why.
Yeah.
And many diseases that we don't think about, if we acquire them, we start thinking about them. And we just don't understand why this happens, what triggers asthma. It can also often happen early in life. So if if as a baby you contract a respiratory illness, you're more likely to develop asthma later on. We don't understand why that is. There's certainly genetic components that contribute to it. There are environmental components, and there are even probably the bacteria that live in us have something to do with it, and we just don't understand this.
In terms of the study of RNA viruses as a whole, are RNA viruses the majority of viruses, or are there more DNA viruses? And then we also get into the question of... I'm totally blanking on the word, but retroviruses that insert themselves into the DNA of hosts.
Right. So, of course, the RNA viruses are the most interesting, but I'm afraid they are outnumbered by DNA viruses. That number 10 to the 30th viruses in the oceans of the world, most of those are DNA viruses.
Okay.
So I think the DNA viruses predominate. But, you know, in terms of viruses that cause human disease, the majority are RNA-containing viruses. I don't know what that means, but it makes me feel good that I'm working on an RNA virus.
Right. It's interesting. I find it interesting that our cells contain DNA, and it's not the DNA viruses that are the ones that are most likely to make us sick, and that the RNA viruses are more likely to infect and cause illness, yet they're the lower number in the environment.
Yeah,
it's a really interesting circle right there.
Well, we don't want to take away the role that DNA viruses play in our health. I mean, there's certainly many that do bad things. Smallpox virus is a DNA virus, and that decimated millions and millions of people over the years until it was eradicated. The human papillomaviruses are DNA-containing viruses, the herpes viruses. They're quite ubiquitous, and they do cause a lot of human disease. But in terms of the diversity of different kinds of diseases, the RNA viruses win. And it's just not clear why that's the case. It may be that the RNA viruses are masters of change, you know, like influenza viruses change. Many of the RNA viruses are just like that. And they can adapt to different hosts and different niches, if you will. And maybe that's why they've been so successful.
Is there evidence that suggests that the RNA viruses have a higher mutation rate or a higher adaptation rate than DNA viruses?
Absolutely, yes.
Okay.
So RNA viruses have a really, really high mutation rate, orders of magnitude higher than DNA viruses. And that's because the proteins or the enzymes that copy their nucleic acid make errors, like all such enzymes do, but they can't fix them. They can't correct the errors.
Mm-hmm.
So in every cycle of replication, whenever you make a new RNA of a particular virus, there's at least one or two mistakes in that RNA. So yes, we call them the masters of mutation.
The masters of mutation. Fabulous. Well, right now I'm going to mutate this show into a message for our sponsor. So without any further ado, I'd like to thank Squarespace for sponsoring this episode of Dr. Kiki's Science Hour. Squarespace.com is the fast and easy way to create a high-quality website or blog. Squarespace.com has an easy-to-use user interface for creating and managing a website or a blog. Optimized for both beginners and CSS experts, there are hundreds of designs to choose from, and you can customize any of the designs to fit your needs. There are also iPhone and iPad apps for updating your blog on the go, if you're one of those go-go-go type of people. There are online resources and a special support team to give you personal help 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And it's an all-inclusive service that includes all sorts of modules to help you build your website. Additionally, website tracking is available so that you know how many times your site is viewed. And there's a built-in search engine optimizer with permission access handling, cloud architecture for speed and site stability. Use Squarespace for all of your website needs. Build it, host it, and update it anytime. For a free trial, go to squarespace.com. That's squarespace.com. Sign up for a free account. There's no credit card needed. Just try it out. Start building your website. And then if you decide to purchase it after you've already had a free trial to test everything out, use the offer code KIKI7 when it comes time to pay. And you'll get 10% off of your account for 6 months. That's 10% off for 6 months. Use the offer code KIKI7. Go to squarespace.com to get your account started. That's right. I'd like to thank squarespace.com for sponsoring this hour of Dr. Kiki Science Hour and for sponsoring TWiT. So, Vincent, back to the viruses. This is just such a fascinating subject to me, figuring out, you know, how we get sick, what makes us sick. Every once in a while, we come across the beneficial bacteria. Not all bacteria make us sick. Are all viruses bad? Are there beneficial viruses that actually help us out instead of just make us sick, give us the common cold, give us the flu?
There must be. We have many viruses in us that don't seem to do anything. They're with us for our entire lives. And one of the ideas is that they have beneficial effects. There's certainly lots of examples in other types of life of beneficial viruses. My favorite one is a virus that is carried by a wasp. And this is a wasp that lays eggs inside caterpillars. Now, normally, the eggs would be kicked out by the caterpillar. But when the wasp puts a virus in with the egg, the virus inhibits the caterpillar from rejecting the egg.
Right.
So the virus is beneficial to the wasp. And there are lots of examples of that in non-human examples. I suspect we have beneficial viruses as well, and it's just a matter of us sorting them out because there are just so many of them around us, and we carry so many of them without symptoms that they must be doing us some good.
Yeah, you mentioned carrying viruses without symptoms. There are a number of, retroviruses that we've identified in our DNA that just kind of sit there and don't do anything. And aren't there some French labs that have taken these retroviruses out and then tried to synthesize them into viruses in dishes in the lab?
Sure. So these retroviruses are RNA viruses, but their life cycle is unique because they make a DNA copy of that RNA as part of their life cycle. And that DNA goes into our chromosomes, as you said. About 8% of the human genome consists of these retroviral DNAs.
That's
been there for many. Yeah, it's quite a bit.
Yeah.
And they've been there for years. None of them in humans make virus particles. They're dead, as we say. But you can take the sequences out of our chromosomes and fix them in the lab, and you can make viruses. You can resuscitate ancient extinct viruses. And the question really is, why are they still there? They've probably been there since before we evolved into Homo sapiens. They must be doing something. There is actually evidence in other animals that these retroviruses are doing something. So for some of them, some proteins are actually made that assist in specific development. So I think we have yet to learn if these are doing something, but that's one of the candidates for maybe viruses being beneficial, those retroviruses in our genomes.
Yeah, so similarly to the way that our cells ended up taking up the endosymbionts that became our mitochondria, maybe these retroviruses got added to our DNA and enable us to make certain proteins that allow, say, certain metabolic processes to occur. Digestion
Absolutely.
Of certain things, enzymatic processes or whatnot.
Yeah, that's the idea. They came in and they evolved to a state where we use them, And that's not unreasonable. You know, a cell picks up a piece of DNA, and if it can provide a useful function, it will be selected for.
I'd like to jump into some kind of current news and things that have been going on in the virology media. Is there virology media? I guess there would be. but the first off the top of my head, it's close to my heart because I went to school at UC Davis and I actually worked at the UC Davis Primate Center one summer. There's a monkey human virus that my co-host on This Week in Science and I were joking about it being monkeypox. It's not monkeypox, but it is a virus that has made some kind of a jump from human to monkey or monkey to human, and it shouldn't have happened, and people and monkeys have gotten sick. Do you know much about that?
I know a bit about it. We haven't yet covered this on TWIV, but this is a virus that is called monkey adenovirus. So adenoviruses are viruses that have DNA as their genetic material. They're rather large as DNA viruses go, not the biggest, but they're big. And then in humans, certain kinds of adenoviruses cause colds. They cause eye infections. So if you ever get a red eye from swimming in a hot tub or a pool that's not been properly sanitized, it could be an adenovirus. And they also cause gastroenteritis. So human adenoviruses are well known. There are many of them. We don't vaccinate against them, but because there are many different kinds of them, but they do cause significant disease. Now, in this case, it involved a primate center where a lot of the monkeys had been infected. This was a couple of years ago, with a virus that was causing respiratory illness and pneumonia and killed quite a few of the monkeys.
Yeah.
And at the time that this outbreak was occurring, some of the monkey handlers got sick as well. And they isolated this adenovirus from both the monkeys and the human. So it's not uncommon that animal handlers also pick up the viruses that make the animals sick, because they're working very close with them and they get, you know, bodily fluids. In this case, it's a respiratory virus. The monkeys are always sneezing and throwing material at you, as monkeys are wont to do.
Yeah.
So it's very easy to get infected. In fact, there's an outbreak of a horse virus in Australia, Hendra virus, which comes from a bat to the horse. And when the racehorses get infected, their handlers get infected as well. So where the virus came from at Davis is very interesting. We don't know the origin of it. Usually these monkey colonies are inbred, and there's no chance for virus to come, say, from a wild monkey that's captured and put into the colony. So it'll be interesting to figure out where this came from. There's no evidence that it went from person to person, which you would then be worried about. So this is a one-way trip. It goes from the monkey to the person, and then it ends there. So it's scientifically very interesting to understand why this occurs, but it's not really something to get scared about, I think.
Right. I think the big concern is that it would be that the mortality rate would be as high as in humans after making the jump from monkey to humans as it was for the monkeys, because the monkey population at the primate center was actually pretty devastated by the illness, if I recall. And
that's right. Yeah, there's something like 83% mortality. Yeah.
Which is really high.
It certainly is high. And this is often what you see in these virus infections that jump from an animal to human. We call these zoonotic infections because they come from animals. Often the animals are either sick or not sick at all. And then the humans get sick, but much less so. Ebola, Marburg viruses are examples where the virus comes from an animal that's fine. It comes from a bat, and then the humans get sick, but it's relatively restricted. So there's no reason to assume that the mortality would be as high in people as in the animal, because it's not well adapted to people, and so it's not likely to cause disease.
Right. What's going on with the Hendra virus? And you mentioned that it's going from bat to horses, but in this particular case, there's a dog involved as well. So virus has jumped an additional species.
Well, we're not sure. That's a good thing to discuss. So Hendra virus originally was found in Australian racehorses a number of years ago, and it was identified as coming from a fruit bat. Mm. And the fruit bats are fine. They're highly infected with this virus, but
it's
when
like
they
a background
contaminate,
infection. It doesn't affect the population.
It doesn't. Maybe it actually helps them. Right? One of those viruses that helps the bat. But when the bats contaminate horse feed, which they do, because there's all that food sitting out there that the horses are going to eat, they contaminate. When the horses eat it, then they get very sick. Mm. And then the horse handlers get sick as well. And it can be lethal. And these are race horses, so there's a lot of financial at stake. On one of these farms, there's an ongoing outbreak at the moment in Australia of Hendra on horse farms. And on one of the farms, a dog was identified with antibodies that cross-react with a Hendra virus protein. So they tried to isolate virus from the blood of this dog. The dog is not sick, but they couldn't do that. And what they found is in the serum, something that reacts with Hendra. And it doesn't mean the dog was infected with Hendra. It could have been a related virus. Mm-hmm. It might not even have been infected at all. But many people are worried about this because they think, oh, it's going to go from horses to dogs and then more
dogs
efficiently
to
into people. Yeah.
Right. So the I guess the clincher here in this story is that at this point in time, because it's basically antibodies, you're finding something that reacts to, so that there are cells in the dog that have a memory of some infection that may have been Hendra, it may have been something else that react
right.
to Hendra virus. But the dog the dog itself isn't actually sick. Was it sick?
I don't recall actually if it was sick or not. It must have been some reason why they looked at it. But it's now fine. It's recovered if it were sick. And all they can find are antibodies. So, as you say, it could have been Hendra, it could have been a related virus, or it may not have even replicated in the dog. My dog might just have gotten a lot of virus, say, from a horse and made antibodies against it.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, the press is treating it as an infection and the first time the virus has been isolated from dogs. And we have to remember, we haven't isolated any virus here. To say that we isolated a virus, you actually have to get the virus from the animal and grow it in culture or do some kind of analysis that shows that the virus is there.
Is that hard to do? Is it harder to find virus than it is to find compounds that are reactive to virus in an organism?
Well, this is a really interesting question because now we have incredibly sensitive ways to look for viral nucleic acid. Mm-hmm. So we have polymerase chain reaction, which can detect very small amounts of nucleic acid. So in some ways, it's very easy to do that. It's very hard often to propagate the virus in cells because many viruses that you get from an animal simply don't grow in cells in culture. But you can use these nucleic acid techniques and detect them very readily. The problem is that you have to be very careful not to contaminate your reactions. It's very easy to do since these are so sensitive. It's easy to contaminate them. So the quick answer is yes, it's pretty easy to detect them nowadays, but you have to be very careful of contamination.
Right, and I'm sure there are many methods to be able to cross-check and counter-check and make sure that you are not contaminating or to make sure that you haven't added anything unwanted to your mix.
Yes. Well, sometimes it happens without you knowing it. And you have to, as you say, you have to be very careful to do all the proper controls to check for that kind of contamination.
Yeah. Another interesting story in the news, it's kind of related to virology by the individual who is involved. Peter Duisberg, I mentioned the story at the top of the hour in our science headlines about his recent paper on cancer and basically mm-hmm. saying that cancer is a parasite and that it is when you get cancer, a tumor is a new species within your body, that there's speciation happening. And Duisberg has notoriety in the scientific community for being an HIV AIDS denialist.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that How does he play into these stories? Is he a virologist? What is he have to
say? So Peter Duesberg, yeah, Peter Duesberg is a virologist. He at one time was a very well-known virologist who studied retroviruses, these viruses that we talked about earlier. And then at some point, shortly after HIV was shown to be the agent of AIDS, he started saying that it wasn't, and there was no good proof that it caused AIDS. And this is really old now because it's quite clear that HIV causes AIDS. We have many, many independent lines of evidence. So I'm not sure why he did that at the time. I have a suspicion that maybe part of his motive was to stimulate thinking differently, and maybe he really didn't feel it but wanted just to jog the field. So now he thinks that cancers are a parasite. So
yes.
A parasite is a different species that benefits at the expense of another.
Which, right? Viruses, so now. I mean, we said at the top of the hour, viruses are parasites.
That's right. Viruses are parasites. There are insects that are parasites. There are eukaryotic organisms that are parasites, like Trichinella and hookworm. These are different species that go into a different species and take from them what they need.
Yeah.
Cancer are your cells that are replicating uncontrollably as a consequence of a series of mutations that have occurred in those cells. So to think of them as a parasite is incorrect. Now, the caveat here is, of course, we define everything, right? We say,
yes,
this is what a parasite is. And that's what science is all about. We make these categories and we put things in them.
Yeah. Are you
but
a lumper
the idea
or a spinner?
That, yeah, exactly. And, you know, we have a pretty good idea what a cancer is. It's our cells that have lost their programming, and they multiply and they form tumors and they don't stop. So I don't understand why he would view it as a parasite at all and you know, a different species. He's calling, in this article that has come out of Berkeley, he's calling it a different species. So this makes no sense to me. I mean, I'm not a cancer biologist, but I have a good understanding of what happens in transformation and oncogenesis, and it doesn't make any sense to me. Now, one of the things he cites is this transmissible cancer among Tasmanian devils. You may know that there's this cancer that is wiping out these cute little animals.
Yeah.
Cute, depending on how. Right.
And they get facial tumors, facial lesions. Yeah.
Right. And then, so what they do is they fight with each other and they bite and they transmit the cancer from one to the other because it's a very invasive cancer. And you get a few cells from one devil to the other and it begins to multiply and evades immune responses in the other. So it doesn't provide any support for his theory whatsoever. It's just a cancer that is highly transmissible. It's not evidence for a parasitic relationship.
Yeah. Is there, there are viral causes of some cancers, though, aren't there?
Mm-hmm.
So there is.
In animals, in humans.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, in humans, one of the well-known cancers for which we have just made a vaccine is cervical tumors caused by human papillomaviruses.
Right.
And we have a vaccine that prevents that now. And there are a few other viruses that cause human tumors and cancers, and there are many that cause cancers in animals. And we understand how they work. So, for example, some of these viruses that cause tumors, they affect cells. And viruses like cells to be dividing because viruses, in order to reproduce, they like dividing cells. They like active cells. And many cells in our body are quiescent. So when these viruses get in, they kick them into replicating. And the cells divide and divide and divide without stopping. And that is a recipe for becoming a cancer cell because mutations begin to accumulate and eventually become a cancer. So that's one reason why I don't think that Duesberg's theory is very tenable, because we have very precise examples of how viruses cause cancer, and it doesn't fit at all with his theory.
Yeah. We're coming up towards the end of the show, and I wanted to take a turn into what you do on the side of your researcher. You're also a podcaster yourself. You have This Week in Virology, This Week in Parasitology, and more recently This Week in Microbiology.
Microbiology.
That's yeah. Correct. So we were talking a little bit before the show about how you've become somewhat a rock star or a pod star among scientists at the science conventions.
Right. So we started podcasting just, I did years ago. I was actually inspired by the Twit Network and heard Leo once say that if you're passionate about something, you should podcast about it. So we started This Week in Virology. And I had no idea where it would head, but it was incredibly successful. And as I told you earlier, we passed 1 million downloads not too long ago. We have a great following. And it's not just among scientists, but non-scientists as well. We have all sorts of individuals who want to learn about viruses and find it hard to find reliable information.
Would you
say, I think this is a good...
Would you say that your shows are... appropriate for a general audience, college student types, for, you know, what kind of an audience are your shows appropriate for?
So amazingly, it seems to be appropriate for a pretty broad swath. We get a lot of emails from listeners, and we can tell what they do. So I would say half are probably some kind of scientist or health professional. And the other half are just people who are interested in science. And I would say they're mostly at the college level and up. We've had a few high school students write into us, but mostly it's higher than that. And many of them say it's hard, but if they keep listening, they eventually pick it up. And they really like to do that. And many people say, you know, they have Google open in front of them, and when they listen to, and they don't understand something, they can Google a term. So actually, I'm amazed that it has such a broad audience because it's fairly sophisticated science. But it encourages us. I think this is great that people want to tackle hard science.
I think it's fabulous. I love that you're finding a good audience and that people are enjoying your shows. You also tweet, and you mentioned to me that you've been live tweeting scientific conferences and that you've caused a little bit of an uproar among your scientific peers. I at this point in time, I just kind of figured that tweeting conferences was something that was accepted and people just did and that people would expect.
Yeah. Well, as you know, in the tech world, everybody tweets, and there are some scientists who are pretty active tweeters. So Jonathan Eisen from Davis, which is your alum, so he tweets often at microbiology meetings, and that's where I had the idea. I went to a virology meeting 2 weeks ago, and they had good internet in the main hall, so I said, let me live tweet this, and I did it every day for 4 days. And a lot of people really appreciated this, hearing what was going on. They couldn't come to the meeting. But a few people came up to me and said, why are you doing that? Do you get permission to do that? You know, you're giving away confidential data. I'm going to get scooped. So I was surprised. I thought it would be more widespread. So I wrote a blog post at virology.ws, and there are actually quite a few interesting comments there. Many people are supportive. They want this to happen. They want it to become the norm eventually, and I think eventually it will, but science, at least in my area, microbiology, we haven't reached the point where live tweeting or live blogging is generally accepted. But I think as younger people move into higher positions where they influence what goes on at meetings, then I'm sure it's going to happen.
Yeah, I think you're right. As the changing of the guard takes place, we'll see more and more of the live tweeting. I would probably get in trouble for tweeting stuff. I think maybe what you might find you need is a precedent where if somebody is going to be citing information that they shouldn't cite, that can't be spread publicly outside of the conference, that they just say at the beginning of their presentation, mm-hmm. please no tweeting, that this information is proprietary, or
I think that's a good idea. I like that.
Yeah.
I like that idea. But I do think it's a valuable thing to do. I think it's all in the spirit of disseminating information. And after all, that is what we should do in science. This is mostly research supported by taxpayer dollars. The taxpayers should know about it. And eventually it's going to spread anyway. So there are 1,000 people at this meeting. And if they go home and tell 10 people about the talks, it's going to spread. So I don't think tweeting is qualitatively much different. It just accelerates the rate at which the information goes out.
Accelerates the dissemination of the viruses of information.
Would you call that viral?
Viral dissemination, exactly.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's right.
I made it funny. Final question. I just would love to know, you as the world's virology professor, you've got your lectern, your podium here with a nice microphone. What do you want people to know about virology and about viruses? What is the most important thing that people should know?
This is great. We talk about this on Twitter all the time. If you had the attention of the whole world
for
one sentence, what would you tell them? Right. So maybe we don't have the whole world, but what would you? The most important thing, you know, unfortunately, I have to say two important things. Viruses can make you sick, and therefore, if there are vaccines, you should take them for you and your kids because they are really good for you. And people who say they are not are simply wrong. The other thing is, some theme that we have talked about here today is that viruses are probably also good for you. And we're not sure yet exactly how. There are many examples in the animal world where they're good for animals. So not all viruses make you sick. And learning about how they're good for us is probably going to be valuable in the long term to keeping us healthier.
Thank you very much. This has been really great. Many thanks to Dr. Vincent Racaniello for joining us today here on Dr. Kiki Science Hour and for all the information about viruses. If you want any more information, be sure to visit his website. TWIV.TV is for This Week in Virology. And the other website, go scroll up and find it, virology.ws. You can find bunch of links. Get more information at these places. I'm Dr. Kiki, and this wraps another show. And next week, we will, of course, have much more science to talk about. I'm not sure exactly what it's going to be yet, but you know, rest assured that it will be an interesting conversation, because that's all I like to have. Until then, you can find me on the internet if you search for Dr. Kiki. I'm Dr. Kiki at Twitter. I am Dr. Kiki on Facebook, and I was Dr. Kiki on Google+ until they suspended me. Whoops. And my website is kirstensanford.com. You can subscribe to this show at iTunes. You can also catch past episodes of Dr. Kiki Science Hour if you go to twit.tv/Kiki. So that about does it. Vincent, what was your Twitter handle in case people want to follow you on Twitter?
PROFVRR.
And you are on Google+ still. You haven't been suspended.
I'm on Google+. They haven't kicked me off. But after I've spoken with you, maybe they will.
I know. Maybe I'm bad luck that way. Anyway, thank you very much, everybody, for joining me today. And remember, all I ask is 1 hour a week. And I do hope that this hour has made your world a whole lot more interesting. See you next week.